Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 1st of September 2018, Episode 3, just quietly reading through for cardiac or cognitive health, and it's just one of those things where I just have to keep on pushing along. Really doesn't matter if anyone's listening to me all that much. Okay, biology's cornerstone can be a threat to our health and even our civilization. Michael Lepage finds out how to stop its dark side. Over billions of years, evolution has created a stunning variety of life on Earth, including humans. Even now, it is helping wildlife adapt to the enormous changes we are making to the planet. But evolution has a dark side too. Beautiful English. For a start, it can be a hazard to health. It is why cancers kill 1 in 5 of us, grow ever more dangerous as they progress, and stop responding to treatments. It's also why antibiotic-resistant superbugs are becoming more common, and why killer diseases like malaria can evade drugs. It takes a toll on our food and our environment too, as farmers battle to keep rapidly evolving pests and weeds under control. And it is behind the resurgence of infestations we thought were long defeated, including head lice, bed bugs and rats. It is no exaggeration to say that the future of civilization depends on halting these threatening kinds of evolution. Beautifully put, isn't it? This ambition may sound like hubris, but biologists have long been seeking ways to do just that. They now come up with a whole array of approaches, including creating immutable genes, turning gene editing tools into anti-evolution super weapons, and making viruses mutate so fast that they cannot evolve. Quote, "We can even reverse antibiotic resistance," says Lee Cron of the University of Glasgow, UK. We tend to think of evolution as a process that happens over millions of years, not as something we need to worry about in a practical terms. In fact, it can be rapid and has been causing problems for humanity since the dawn of civilization. When early farmers started weeding by hand, the plants evolved to outwit them by looking more like crops. In the industrial age, evolution has become an industrial-scale problem. Almost as soon as we started using penicillin to treat infections, DDT to kill mosquitoes, and herbicides to destroy weeds, resistance began to emerge. The reason is simple. When we try to wipe out a pest and pathogens, we put huge pressures on them to evolve or die. If a poison isn't totally effective, those individuals that survive are likely to have some resistance to it, and their offsprings may acquire mutations that even make them more resistant. With repeated exposure to a poison, a population can evolve resistance very quickly. Warfarin, my favourite drug. Oh yeah, sorry. Well, I'm using warfarin. It's my rat killer. Warfarin was first used to catch real killer rats in 1948, and the earliest report of resistance came just a decade later. In fast-reproducing organisms like viruses and bacteria, the process can take just days or hours. Evolution is happening right here, right now, all around us, and even inside us. Cancer is an evolutionary disease. As we are evolving to evade the drugs meant to kill them, cancer cells evolve to dodge the immune system's attacks, to trick the body into supplying them with food and oxygen and spread. Evolution also explains why organisms have a domesticated or engineered to perform specific tasks sometimes go rogue. For instance, oral polio vaccinine is a weakened virus that has a habit of evolving back into the full on disease-causing virus. And the bacteria and yeast used to manufacture a myriad of products tends to evolve to do our biddings less well with time. That would be a thing that you would want to have a bank, a frozen bank. It's an enormously expensive problem. Back in 2001, Stephen Palmer of Stanford University, California, calculated that evolution was probably costing the US more than $100 billion a year. This estimate has not been updated, but the figure would have to be far higher today, he says. So what can we do? Lots, actually. Quote, "Evolution is not a dreaded enemy that the media makes out," says Cronin. We have already won some notable battles in our struggles against it. Take the triple therapy for HIV. In the 1990s, doctors began combining three drugs to make it very hard for the virus to evolve resistance to all of them. Quote, triple drug therapy is one of the truly evolutionary treatment strategies, says Palumbi. Quote, this approach seems to have given life back to millions of people. In fact, halting evolution can be as easy as removing the pressure that drives the natural selection. For instance, the fungus that causes crop disease called rice blast became resistant to a new fungicide within just 3 years. When farmers in Japan stopped using it, the resistant strain disappeared in 4 years. It isn't even necessary to stop using a fungicide or pesticide. You just need to ensure susceptible pests outbreed the resistant one. Where farmers grow crops genetically engineered to produce BT toxin and insecticide, pests become resistant within a matter of years. But if farmers plant mixes of BT and non-BT plants, large numbers of BT susceptible insects survive. These mate with the fewer BT-resistant pests, swamping the emergence in resistance. The approach undoubtedly works, however, farmers are reluctant to grow lots of non-BT plants. Reverse the pressure. It's even harder to persuade people not to overuse antibiotics. Antibiotics resistance is getting rapidly worse and threatening to undo the century of progress in medicine. Yet, even there, there's hope. As paradoxically as it sounds, some researchers think we can use antibiotics to reverse the selection pressures on bacteria and make them susceptible to antibiotics again. Quarles and his colleagues are among the dozens of teams working on this. They have been experimenting with alternating two antibiotics that attack different aspects of bacteria. The basic idea is not new. Alternating chemicals with different modes of action has long been used to prevent pesticide resistance arising. But it has not been applied to antibiotics before. Cronin's team has developed a model to work out how to optimize the effect and shows that it works in cells growing in culture. Quote, we actually were able to reverse the resistance over time. We were not expecting that, he says. What's more, the model suggests this approach could help prevent cancers becoming drug resistant too. Meanwhile, CRISPR, clustered regularly interspaced palindromic repeats gene editing is allowing us to tackle evolution head on in an entirely novel way. The technology can target and destroy specific DNA sequences with all kinds of potential applications. Quote, if someone told me several years ago we could do this, I would have said, you're crazy, said Anjeko Chevs at the Columbia University, New York. CRISPR involves two linked components, a Cas9 protein and a guide RNA. Cas9 scans the cell's RNA until it finds a sequence that matches the part of the guide RNA, beautifully written, and then cuts the RNA at a specific site. So the appropriate guide, CRISPR, can chew the DNA coding the antibiotic resistance or another unwanted traits without killing the bacterium carrier. In other words, it can be used to reverse evolution. The tricky part is getting CRISPR toolkit inside the bacterium. This can be done in viruses known as bacteriophages, which replicate themselves by injecting their DNA into bacteria. Geneticists hijack these phages, swapping the viral DNA for a DNA that codes for CRISPR components. Several companies have successfully used modified phages to treat antibiotic resistance infections in animals and humans. Clinical trials could start soon. But there are some big limitations. For a start, specific phages infect specific bacteria, so each treatment must be customized. In addition, phages don't survive in the bloodstream, so cannot be used to treat internal infections, although they could be sprayed onto the wounds or used to target bacteria in the guts. Well, that's something I didn't know. I didn't know bacteriophages don't survive in the bloodstream. This bacteriophage, they're pretty evil-looking beasts. Resistance is futile. Yuri Quim Moron of Tel Aviv University Israel wants to use slashes in different ways to resensitize the bacteria to antibiotics before they get a chance to infect people. His plan is to add CRISPR flashes to sprays for the cleaning surfaces in hospitals and for creams that medics use to wash their hands. If we continually use such creams, we can eventually reduce the ratio of resistant bacteria to sensitive bacteria, he says. This wouldn't be easy, not at least because CRISPR flashes do not spread in hospitals or everywhere because they can't replicate. They don't carry viral genes. That is an advantage for the safety point of view, but it seems their effectiveness, But Kroon has a cunning plan. He engineered flashes that are harmless to you, harmless to the resensitized bacteria, but can replicate in the wild and kill other bacteria. He hopes to use both kinds of flashes together so that the antibiotic resistant bacteria, not resensitized by one, are destroyed by the other. Yeah, I think it's deeply confused. Or I'm deeply confused. It'll be very difficult to eliminate all resistant cells in complex environments, points out evolutionary biologist Jeffrey Barrick of the University of Texas Austin, but it's hard with conventional methods too. Jeffers is taking a different track. Instead of using CRISPR to reverse evolution, his team wants to stop specific traits evolving in the first place. Quote, we wondered if you have a CRISPR hide on the genome be calm, do nothing, and when something arises you don't like, have CRISPR snip it out, he says. To find out, his team created a CRISPR system that targets mutations known to make specific strain of E. coli resistance to antibiotic rimethicin. Next, they inserted the system into non-resistant E. coli. They then put the bacteria into the gut of mice, which they dosed with rifaximin. Resistant mutants appeared within days and the mouse was given the unaltered bacteria, but not in those with the engineered strains. This anti-evolution system could be used in all kinds of ways. The most obvious, to stop unwanted mutations occurring in microorganisms we use to manufacture a huge variety of products, from beer to insulin to vanilla flavouring. Quote, a lot of times when you are growing stuff in large vats, fermenters, over time microbes lose their ability to make the substances of interest, says Chairs. That makes sense because making those substances is a huge metabolic drain on them, but it's a headache for the manufacturers. Barrett's team is addressing the problem by creating anti-mutators bacteria with lower mutation rates. One way of doing this is by removing the so-called genomic parasites, DNA sequences found in organisms that provide no benefit but greatly increase the mutation rate. Another way to improve the accuracy of the enzyme is to copy DNA, which can reduce the mutation to up to 34. I'll reread that one again. Another way to improve the accuracy of enzymes that copy DNA, you could do better enzymes. It's also to make DNA itself immutable, or at least less prone to mutation. One way is to give a particular DNA sequence exact functions, making it more valuable so that if it does mutate, the organism will be less likely to survive. For example, by weakening a promoter sequence, so it controls the action of two genes instead of one. Researchers have reduced mutation rates tenfold. So, look, there are whole sequences, exons, introns, I've forgotten the various things, but there's inhibitors and starters, and so there's all these computing aspects in an actual gene. Other biologists are doing exactly the opposite. They're capitalising on the fact that very high mutation rates can stop organisms adapting and evolving, and even drive them to extinction. A few experimental drugs are thought to work in this way, including one that shows promise against viruses causing disease ranging from flu to Nile virus. This approach may be effective against only viruses that encode their genetic information in RNA, because they have very high mutation rates to start with. But Chevers' anti-evolution system should work in a much wider range of organisms, perhaps even wild plants, animals, such as mosquitoes and rats. CRISPR has already made and been adapted to make artificial gene drives, DNA sequences that copy themselves within the genome in such a way that it gets passed on to all the animal's offspring, not just half of them. Quote, could you have this on the gene drive? You could have this on a gene drive that spreads in a population. That's in theory benign to the population and just prevents them from evolving to something you don't want. I think that's totally reasonable, says Chavez. That's insane. I think that is just insane. Oh. CRISPR promises a whole new way to tackle the dark side of evolution. And so it's interesting to see what CRISPR is. CRISPR is a piece of guard RNA with, which is, so the DNA of a bacteria has a piece of guide RNA, which, and it also matches the CRISPR enzyme and puts the two together, and this goes as basically an immune system of bacteria. So it goes around chopping up the rogue DNA coming into itself. It just eats it away, destroys it. They are not foolproof. But unlike with the conventional drugs and pesticides where you must start from scratch once resistance evolves, CRISPR components can be just tweaked to target new DNA sequences. Sequence-specific antimicrobials could be very powerful, said Chavez. That power comes responsibility. Genetically based tools really do change the evolutionary dynamic, says Palumbi. We really need to be sure that we don't create an unintended consequences. I think you bloody will have to be. And that is difficult. For example, it has recently been shown that some vaccines can drive the evolution to more dangerous viruses. Quote, it requires a great deal of thought and experimentation, appreciation of power, and the unluckiness at times of evolution, he says. One thing is certain, even if the new weapons in our struggle against evolution, it's not a conflict that will ever end. You will never completely solve the problem, says Palumbi. You need to step ahead along the whole way. We are living incredible times. I mean, we are just, I think the diagnostics, the incredible diagnostics that we have now is just astounding. Here's the next article, as I'm 17 minutes in. Nuclear comeback. Nuclear power is dying in the West, but a raft of new technologies could bring back one of the going to say thorium. Okay. Queen Elizabeth II climbed the five metal steps to the platform of and spoke a few words into a microphone. She pulled a lever and the deed was done. The giant dial on the nearby building began to spin as electricity sparked into life. She just opened UK's first atomic power station, Calder Hall. The crowd clapped and cheered that sunny day in 1956, but a gloom has since descended on nuclear power. There is radioactive waste, the decommissioning, and the accidents from Chernobyl to Fukushima. As concern about climate change increased, nuclear's one saving grace became that it's carbon free. But now, the cost of much renewable energy has fallen below that of nuclear. These days we produce little more power from nuclear than we did 20 years ago. So, just as we need as much clean energy as we can, it seems we're spurning our best developed source of it. Is it really time to call time on nuclear? The cheers around Calder Hall in 56 had nothing on the spirit of optimism that surrounded the birth of nuclear power a decade earlier. Scientists had worked out that splitting heavy atoms released huge amounts of energy that could be used for more than just bombs. There was talk of everything from nuclear-powered moon shuttles to plutonium-heated swimming pools. Over the following two decades, nuclear reactors big enough to match a coal power station's power output came online in more than 30 countries. Much of the technology's bad rap today in Europe and US centers on the mountains of waste those plants have since produced. Nuclear reactors typically bombard uranium with neutrons to induce an ongoing process of fission, where the uranium atom splits into smaller pieces, releasing lots of heat. The heat is used to generate electricity with highly radioactive elements left over. There might be a few ways of dealing with the waste, although there still remains a huge cost spread over decades associated with decommissioning the reactor itself. But other developments are making the economies of nuclear power look extremely shaky. The cost of electricity is generally quoted per megawatt hour, with 1 megawatt hour being roughly the power a tumble dryer uses in a year. The government, that's in the UK of course, the government, because we don't bother you buyers here. Okay. The Kiev government has guaranteed that the owners of the Hinkley Point C nuclear power station, whose construction has begun in Somerset, will be able to sell their electricity at £92.50 per megawatt hour. Meanwhile, some onshore turbines are being commissioned on the assumption that they will sell their energy at 30 megawatt hours, £30 per megawatt hour. Okay, now not to read that, I'll come back and read that trash to treasure. Okay. These economics are part of the reason why, after decades of growth, installed nuclear capacity around the world has plateaued since around 2000, even falling in some places, the nuclear plants reach the end of their lives, and a few new ones are built. Belgium, Germany, Switzerland and Spain have all committed themselves to phasing out nuclear power entirely. In July, the UK government, Independent Advisor on Infrastructure, trashed nuclear power, arguing that investing in renewables was cheaper. Quote, "The cost of coming down so quickly on renewables means that you have a limited window for strong growth of nuclear power," says Brent Wander, the International Energy Agency. But renewables are not without their drawbacks. In June and July, the UK experienced a wind drought where the power was down 40% compared with the same period a year early, despite being more turbines. True, such niggles may be slowed with better batteries on methods of storing power, but even then, renewables may not be as cheap as they appear on paper. Erecting enough solar panels or wind turbines to match the output of a nuclear plant would take a vast tract of land. They also only last around 25 years rather than 60 or more offered by atom smashers. Plus, turbines need to be decommissioned just as nuclear plants do. In a recent UK government report, estimated the cost of decommissioning the 37 offshore wind farms being built or already operating across the country. It put the price of removing all the infrastructure associated with the turbines, such as the concrete moorings, up to $6.3 billion. I find it just hard to believe that you're going to say, "I want to decommission a wind farm." I thought you'd just replace the moorings with more efficient wind. I don't understand it. In other words, energy cost statistics can be obscure more than reveal. There are efforts to reduce levelized costs. I just think people should use less electricity, my overall theme, which accounts for as many variables as possible, including, say, the cost of planning infrastructure. The UK government's latest figures show that the cost of offshore wind and nuclear are similar. Onshore wind is much cheaper, but it faces roadblocks in the shape of restricted access to land and limited community support. Blood oath. There is hope that advanced nuclear reactors might be better value. Take the EPR nuclear design, which should produce the same power from 70% of the less uranium, compared with a mid-class pressurized water reactor, one of the most common types. Yet it is a long-term goal. The technology needs financial help to get up and running. Hinkley Point C, which still features a pair of EPR reactors, is a case in point. There's only a small handful of EPRs. I don't know what EPR stands for. Plants being built globally, the first of which in China, which is connected to the grid by the end of the June. But construction of that plant, known as Cheshan 1, began almost a decade ago. Let's see if I can see what EPR stands for. No, they haven't told us. That speaks of the real problem with nuclear plants, as uncovered in a study from Joana Portugal Pereira at Imperial College London and her colleagues. They compiled a database of nuclear reactors being built between 55 and 2016, and the costs involved in constructing them. They found the length of time taken to build the new plants doubled over the past 50 years. Jacopo Borgiorno in Massachusetts Institute of Technology and his colleagues have analysed why. It's not the materials or the technologies themselves that are the problem. Each reactor is bespoke and the installation takes a serious time and money, from digging the foundation and otherwise preparing the site to pouring the concrete. So it's bespoke. In principle, smaller, more uniform reactors should be cheaper. And that's the notion behind what are called small modular reactors, SMR. They would be built to a standardized design and prefabricated before shipping around the world, making installation much more routine. The most talked about firm developing this technology is NuScale, headquartered in Oregon. This design involves a jacket of water that circulates and cools the inner reactor by convection. This is simpler than relying on pumps to do more to move the water and make it easier to produce many copies of the reactors quickly and cheaply. Okay, that's like boiling a bottle of water. NuScale has yet to build a working reactor, but it has passed the first of the most challenging phase of design certification reviewed by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Full approval may be granted as soon as 2020, but because the firm won't make any money from the reactors for years, it needs serious financial backing. What has plenty of people interested in is that NuScale now has the backing. The US recently announced $60 million of federal funding for the nuclear research and development, and two-thirds of that has gone to NuScale to help with finalise its design. Nuclear on sea. The first aim to have the first SMR running in 2016. The firm, okay, small modular reactor. In the meantime, it may be joined by another company with experience building nuclear reactors, Rolls-Royce. The company has traditionally produced these for military submarines, not civil projects, but says it's keen to develop SMRs for global export. Yet these are a long and uncertain game. Okay, one pro-nuclear think tank says they could eventually produce electricity for as little as 28 pounds per megawatt hour. However, the UK government estimates suggest that even by 2031, it will be a third more expensive than conventional nuclear. This is small ones. For Borogino, they also neglect an obvious innovation. If preparing the land or for a reactor is problematic part of the nuclear power, well, just put them in the ocean. Quote, we think offshore concept can slash the cost quite dramatically, he says. In 2015, Borgonio and his colleagues published their own ideas for a floating nuclear plant, which would send electricity to shore along undersea cables. Floating plants could take advantage of seawater cooling. Poor fish. Okay. Having much more water around would be particularly useful in cooling during an overheating accident. Oh, great fun. Also, the plants are already a reality. Russia launched its first purpose-built facility a few months ago, and China has also expressed interest in building its own fleet. Warner reckons that there's something in it. He argues that floating plants could have more favourable economies than traditional designs. They offer portability too. Plants could be towed to remote communities or offshore engineering operations. They might even provide a zero-carbon way to supply the power needed to install wind turbines. With at first blush, floating nuclear might sound a terrible idea. What if the radioactive material spills into the ocean? Yet Borgino says the plants would enjoy, quote, inherent protection from the earthquakes and tsunamis and the forces that cause the nuclear accidents in Fukushima. He says that, in principle, it's possible to design a vessel that is resistant to deliberate attacks, including explosions and small torpedoes. Oh, God, I always hate these. But it would be possible to destroy the plant if an enemy tried hard enough. Julius Cho at Nanking Technological University in Singapore, Nanyang, has also pointed out that it couldn't be excess backup power in emergency, as the radioactive leak would be harder to contain. However, safe and affordable nuclear power might become the truth. The truth is that the public reputation is awful amongst New Scientist readers, and that might be the deciding factor, at least in the Western countries. That is a key point for those prophesying the worldwide demise of nuclear. There are still 56 plants being built, nearly a third of them in China. The others planned in India and South Korea. The West may fret over whether nuclear can be reinvented as a small, cheap source of power. But everywhere, the attraction of big atomic energy is still as great as the sunny day of 1956. I really rather like that put together, beautifully put together. We're coming up to 33 minutes. I'm going to have to do little stories here. Trash to treasure. As bugbears goes, nuclear waste is a big one. The trouble is, it remains dangerous for so long. Even thousands of years from now, exposure will cause radiation sickness, which means skin rashes, vomiting, and death, depending on the dose. In the early days, we dumped barrels of waste in old mines. Then we realized these places can be swamped in groundwater, which risks carrying radioactive materials back to the surface. The latest play is to stuff it in a deep deep below ground in places where groundwater can't get to, get at it. Encased in concrete, nuclear waste can be stored in deep geological repositories for generations. This is the best available technology, backed an international consensus, says Neil Hyatt of the University of Sheffield, UK. Could we do better? Hyatt is investigating bespoke materials to radioactive materials that can be mixed instead of concrete. He takes different ceramics and bombards them with radiation to simulate how they would cope with in the future. Quote, you drive the materials to become amorphous in a matter of hours, says Hyatt. He has recently shown that materials based on cadmium, zirconium, titanium and oxygen perform well. I think this is Sinrock again, as far as I can tell. Even better, why not harness the power of radioactive waste rather than hide it away? That's the goal in the approach called transmutation. The idea is that the heavy elements such as plutonium, by far the longest lived kind of radioactive waste, and bombard them with neutrons from a particle accelerator. That splits the nucleus into less hazardous chemicals that are only dangerous and radioactive for about 100 years. It also increases energy, so is a way of getting more out of the waste. That sounds weird and wacko. The idea has never quite come off, largely because the heavy nuclei must be separated from the rest of the waste for it to work. But in 2017, researchers at the Tokyo Institute of Technology reported that the need for separation can be avoided by instead using a moderator that slows down the release of neutrons, allowing the unseparated waste to absorb them better. Perfect that the process, and we don't need to hide our nuclear waste anymore. That sounds absolutely wacko insane from knowing a bit about nuclear waste. Okay, uranium in the water. Every year, some 67,000 tons of uranium is mined from the ground. Most is destined to fuel nuclear power stations. You might think that the entrails a lot of carbon emissions associated with diggers. In fact, and I'll suggest that this is not much of a problem. Only about 1 gram of carbon dioxide is emitted per kilowatt hour of energy generated. Even so, uranium mining has its downsides, sometimes allowing radioactive material to seep into rivers. One long considered alternative to mine this stuff from seawater instead. Every 100,000 kilograms of ocean water holds 3 grams of uranium, meaning the sea has 500 times the amount of known to exist on land. In 2017, Gary Gill and his colleagues at the Pacific Northwest Laboratory in Washington set up an experiment to extract it, and thus emerged clumps of acrylic fibers in 3 tons and pumped seawater through them for a month. The fibers trapped a range of elements, including uranium. In June this year, they reported that they had managed to retrieve 5 grams of powdered uranium, known as yellowcake, and the largest amount ever retrieved from seawater. Based on that, quote, we think we can produce it for about $250 per kilogram of uranium, says GBR. That's about 5 times the price of mined uranium, but GIB, or believes that he can make his ocean extracted variety competitive given time. Don't they all? It's failing light here, so I'll issue this one out. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close.
It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.